Hello, listeners. This is Jenny Brentis. I'm in studio in New York. Connor is calling in from Buffalo, New York. We have a jam-packed show for you today with lots of NFL news. Hey, Connor, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm here at the lovely Marriott Amherst Niagara Hotel, where I've been questioned by multiple people about my ability to use the concierge lounge. So things are going well up here so far, I would say.
Looks like you're trying to gain access into an unauthorized area.
I feel like I'm platinum, titanium, whatever.
That's
I should
right.
be able to go wherever I want.
You are authorized. Well, so we have the news topics today, but Connor, you wrote an excellent MMQB this week. You led with a great section about Vic Fangio and Mike Munchak, who grew up 3 miles from each other in NEPA, Northeast Pennsylvania, in Ore territory. But I think perhaps the most memorable takeaway from your column was your trial of smelling salts. So before we dive into the news, I really just want you to explain to readers why you went to the lengths to experience this phenomenon.
So I have to give my wife a lot of credit here, who didn't ask a ton of questions. And she controls the Amazon Prime account, and I just texted her one day and I said, listen, the head coach of the Jets takes smelling salts. I need you to buy me smelling salts, and then we will get reimbursed. And
go,
she's
Allie.
Like, okay. Yeah, so no further questions. And then, a couple days later, they arrived in the mail, and I said, hey, when the baby's taking a nap, like, I'd like someone here just in case I accidentally do this wrong and pass out. She's like, sure, no problem. And I'll say that it was very alarming at first, the whole smelling salts thing. Like, I don't know if you're an NFL head football coach, how this would help you. But then as I went through the process, I'm like, okay, I'm feeling more dialed in. I'm feeling more focused. There's just that 30-second window in there where you're pretty sure your brain's going to shut off and you're going to die. That's like where... it sort of got me a little bit,
Okay. Now you're doing this podcast not on the smelling salts. Is that correct?
The smelling salts are locked away. I was initially going to throw them out, but I'm going to take them into work because I want some of my coworkers, other coworkers to try them, but they are safely locked away somewhere in the Ore house where, my dog Ernie can't get them because I feel like that would be a bad thing for him to have.
Yes. Okay. But you want coworkers like myself to experience the 30 seconds of feeling like you're about to die. Thank you, Connor. I appreciate
that. If you want,
Only if I want. All right. We will dive into the news. It has been a busy week, 10 days. The Antonio Brown drama has really just been lingering. The latest, he is with the Raiders, but to borrow general manager Mike Mayock's own terms, may not be all in. Will the mercurial wide receiver end up actually playing in the NFL this season without his favorite helmet? Connor, yet again, the spicy news topics here. Good job writing them.
Thank you. I don't know. What do you think? I mean, I this is one of those things where Antonio Brown has said even before the season started, right, that he doesn't need football anymore and he could walk away if everything isn't on his own terms. He certainly didn't want to play in Pittsburgh. In that way, I think it gives him at least a little bit of leverage because it seems like he doesn't feel he needs to play anymore and that walking away from $30 million might not be as big of a deal to him as other people.
I agree. You know, he has really played into that storyline. I know that the Raiders tried to push back on that, at least initially. John Gruden said he would play without a helmet if he had to, but Brown himself has fed into that narrative. Obviously, it gives him a little bit of leverage, through his social media posts, has indicated that he doesn't necessarily, need to play and what would happen if he walked away. So I think he's tried to use that leverage to his advantage. But the reality is there isn't a lot of leverage here because the NFL has this policy with the helmet. And if it makes an exception or bends the rule in any way, then there are other players who didn't like having to switch into a different helmet. So it's hard to imagine the NFL budging. And so I think, they're trying off testing of all these other helmets. They're trying another round of grievances that they're going to be filed. But I think it's his only option is going to be to play this season, in a different helmet is how I see it.
What do you make of the theory? I was interested, like, I read something by a former NFL receiver who wrote that, like, the NFL is so fast and so crazy and so dangerous that that there's an argument, he felt, an argument to be made that it was more dangerous for Antonio Brown to play with a helmet that he wasn't comfortable with, even if it's technically less safe than a helmet that he is comfortable with, because he can control his body better and maybe do a better job of avoiding a lot of these dangerous collisions because he's comfortable in that environment. I don't know, like, to me it could either be a crazy thing to say, or, you know, it's just crazy enough that it kind of fits into the parallel universe that the players experience on the field.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting. Nate Jackson wrote about that. I also thought it was interesting. James Palmer from NFL Network had a report from Joe Staley, who had used the same shut helmet that Antonio Brown wants to keep wearing. And he was talking about how that helmet stayed in place and didn't move at all. And when he tried to switch it, it slid down on his nose and caused a scar. And so he said he's switched, but he hasn't found one he liked as much as that specific variety. So I do think that's interesting, that there are ones that guys are more comfortable with and thus will, because you always hear players say you can't play scared out in the field, you can't be fearful about hits. So I do think the mindset's part of it. But, you know, it's hard to argue with the NFL's, you know, motivations here. Motivations is the wrong word. It's hard to argue about the idea that you want to get players into the better helmet technology, right? Because the current helmets are better at absorbing force, both rotational and straight on. They're better at absorbing the kind of forces that can cause concussions, even though no helmet will ever completely prevent that from happening. So they're hoping for getting players into the helmets that allow for the marginal gains. The player comfort is something interesting, and obviously they had to factor that in, but it is something that both the league and the union are behind.
What's so weird to me is that, you know, when the whole concussion issue came up and this took center stage and the NFL had to take real and actionable steps towards player safety, one of their biggest opponents, you know, over this time has been current players. And it's strange because they're rules designed to keep them safer. But then when the lowering the helmet stuff came out, when roughing the passer, you know, all these rules that are, you know, designed by panels of people that are really just trying to keep them safer. And their counter argument is kind of similar to Antonio Brown's. It's just, it's more dangerous for me to change the way that I play. And now I have to think before I hit somebody, and that could cost me a second. And, you know, it's just strange that, you know, all along we thought this was something that was paramount to them. But at the same time, you know, we do get some vocal pushback from maybe some of the more vocal guys. Like, I can think of Richard Sherman off the top of my head was very against some of these, some of the new legislation that's come out over the past few years.
Yeah, you're right. That pushback from current players on some of these issues has been interesting. I think one reason for some of the pushback is they wanted involvement in rule changes or things. So with the helmet, you know, because it is something that both the NFL and the NFLPA have been involved in, it is hard to make that argument, I think, for this specific issue, right?
And I think it's just, you know, if you're the Raiders, like, what do you do? And I think that when Mike Mayock made that statement on Sunday, that was the first time that I really saw because Hard Knocks, you can edit a lot of that stuff out and you can make it seem like it's a joking matter and that they're not worried about it. But this is the first time I think we saw some real and legitimate frustration from them, and that they feel that they've exhausted all their efforts. I'm really interested to see where this goes. I mean, you know, what else are they going to do? And at what point do you move forward? Because I do think that there is some there's a win that needs to be had in the locker room, right? You have to pivot this into a positive at some point before you just go totally off the rails and it's time for the regular season to start.
Right. Absolutely. And one of the things they said when they brought Brown in, right, is they wanted him to be a culture changer and his hard work ethic would rub off on players. And so you really see at this point, those things are not coming to fruition. And at this point, you know, you just hope to get him in for the regular season. And I know there's plenty of cases where players are away for training camp, but, you know, if you make this move to bring in a player that forced his way out from the Steelers with many lingering questions, and you add this to a jigsaw puzzle of the Raiders that doesn't make sense in a lot of different ways, you know, and then you see some of that public frustration. I mean, you wonder how much they're second guessing their decision.
Do you think if you had to take a bet week one, is Antonio Brown on the field?
Yes.
Interesting. I don't know. I'm very excited to see what happens here. This is as the Raiders turn and another episode of Hard Knocks tonight as we tape.
The autumn wind is a Raider, there. Connor, in case you hadn't heard.
That's right.
All right. You want to read topic two?
Let's do it. This one, Jimmy Garoppolo went 1 of 6 for 0 yards and an interception last night in a preseason game against the Broncos. This was his first game action since tearing an ACL last September. How do we feel about this? I mean, are we confident that this is just a blip on the radar, that he's back to this player that won 5 games in a row, that adequately filled in for Tom Brady, that was supposed to be the heir apparent to the Patriots dynasty? Or are we a little skeptical of the allure of Jimmy G that kind of hit us all over the past few years?
I think it's unfair to come to any kind of conclusion on a player less than a year after his ACL tear. We mm-hmm. always see this, right? That players are never fully comfortable until after the year mark. I saw Stefania Bell from ESPN, who is their injury expert and a physical therapist, very smart, was talking about him feeling uncomfortable stepping up into his throws, which isn't abnormal coming off an ACL because your knee's kind of isolated and, you know, you feel like anyone on the field could crash into it. So I think we're just starting to see him again in live action. So I'm inclined to give it more time, but I know you wrote about it in the morning huddle, Connor, this morning.
I think that my one thing is, if you're a 49ers fan or if you're even someone in the 49ers organization, you know, how much patience are you affording this situation? I know this is maybe the protections that were built in. If you're someone like Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch, right, you got those abnormally long 6-year contracts so that you could see this rebuild through. But, you know, what if he doesn't have a great season this year? All of the kind of targeted aggression that you make in free agency, all of the draft choices that you've made with the knowledge that everything's okay at quarterback. I mean, I don't know, when do you worry, I guess, if you're the 49ers? And my argument was certainly not now, and certainly maybe not 2 or 3 weeks from now, but does this at least kind of plant the seed in your head, like, okay, that, you know, maybe everything is not settled yet. Maybe everything is not totally okay.
Yeah, I think that's a sharp take as always, Connor. I think you got to the heart of the matter. I would agree that the time is not now, but I do think there are reasons to like keep a close eye on this, because if by the end of the season he at that point hasn't kind of returned to form. I mean, they were so adamant about tamping down the expectations after, you know, the midseason trade and his, you know, his hot start at the end of the 2017 season, and then the injury happens and now it's like the narrative has totally shifted. It's like people are saying, like, is he any good? Should he even be the 49ers starter? Like, that's the narrative that we're at now, which feels too extreme. But by the end of the season, if he hasn't returned to form, I think then it's a conversation.
Do you think that they would be okay, that this team would be competitive if he is, you know, if he ends up settling, like the place that I used to work, they used to call it the Dalton line, which is sort of the median line of quarterback performance, like the exact middle of the NFL. I guess maybe that's sort of changed to whatever, the Manning line or the Flacco line over the years. But if he's right there, like in the middle, just not the best and not the worst, is this a team that's good enough to be competitive in a division with some really good teams?
That's a great question.
I don't know.
I mean, they have a lot on defense, but with all the hype around him and bringing him in, I think the expectation was he would be incredible in Shanahan's system.
I think the key is just not to do, is to just not have any expectations about anybody. You know, I think that would, you know, that would certainly lessen the burden on everybody. You know, just let us all come in and surprise you. You know, always expect the worst. That's what I have said.
I mean, I agree, Connor. We share that motto. Always expect the worst. Always under promise. Think that things are going to go poorly. So I'm glad we share this outlook on life.
That's right.
Before we move to item three, you know, Connor, as most of us have found out the hard way, getting into debt is easy. Getting out is hard, especially if your FICO score isn't great. Thankfully, now there's Upstart.com, the revolutionary lending platform that knows you're more than just your credit score and offers smarter interest rates to help you pay off high-interest credit card debt. Upstart goes beyond the traditional FICO score when assessing your credit worthiness. They actually reward you based on your education and job history in the form of a smarter interest rate. Upstart believes you're more than just your credit score. They believe in you, and they understand that. They make it fast, simple, and easy to check your rate in just a few minutes without affecting your credit score. The best part? Once the loan is approved, most people get their funds the very next business day. Over 200,000 people have used Upstart to pay off credit cards, student loans, fund their wedding, or to make a large purchase. Free yourself from the burden of high-interest credit card debt by consolidating everything into one monthly payment with Upstart. See why Upstart is ranked number one in their category with over 300 businesses on Trustpilot, and hurry to upstart.com/MMQB to find out how low your Upstart rate is. Checking your rate only takes a few minutes and won't affect your credit. That's upstart.com/MMQB. All right, Connor, what's news item number three?
I will say that your ad read there, I think, dovetailed very beautifully into this, because I think that Ezekiel Elliott wishes that Jerry Jones believed in him the way that Upstart believes in its customers. You know, I think that that would be sort of a good addition to their relationship. But Ezekiel Elliott's agent, Rocky Arsenault, told ESPN's Chris Mortensen that the running backs team was upset and offended over Jerry Jones, who was asked about Ezekiel Elliott the other day by reporters, and he said, "Zeke who?" And, you know, on one hand, this could just be holdout politicking, right? Both sides have to dig in order to get what they want. But I think it speaks to a larger point about the way that Jerry Jones has his star quarterback, his star running back, and his star wide receiver all do contracts. And, you know, Ezekiel Elliott, even though it's not the end of his rookie contract, you know, as a running back, you have to consider that in a different bucket. Has he handled this well? Because, you know, this seems like the end of affordability for this Cowboys roster, probably your last chance to really make a dive into the playoffs. But everybody kind of seems not happy, and they're not paying anybody right now.
Yeah, you know, it's really taken a different tone than the Stephen Jones comment that Elliott was the straw that stirs the drink.
Yes.
It's a notable tone shift. They're getting close to the season. They have built their team in a way that they rely on Elliott. You can make an argument about running backs in the NFL, but for the Cowboys, he really is the straw that stirs the drink. So they're going to be in a very tough spot if he's not there. Different from, I think we've talked about this before, but different from the Chargers, who, yeah, of course they're better if Gordon's back, but they're not entirely reliant on him, and they feel, you know, okay, we can develop our other players. You know, they can take a little bit harder line of a stance, whereas I don't know if the Cowboys are in that same spot.
It's so, it's just an interesting tactic to me, right, where you've essentially, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that the Cowboys have been negotiating through the press. And essentially, you know, bottom line, they feel as though Ezekiel Elliott is not as good as Todd Gurley, or is not worthy of the contract that Todd Gurley got. And they think that Dak Prescott is ridiculous for asking to reset the market at the quarterback position, when you look at the history of the position and everybody's in the top 15 or 16 quarterbacks resets the market. I mean, it's just kind of what happens. Jimmy Garoppolo, I think, was at one point the highest paid quarterback. Derek Carr, Matthew Stafford, you know, none of these guys have won anything significant in particular in their lives, but in terms of playoff games and Super Bowls. But, you know, you have Dak Prescott, who 13-3 his first year, winning records each of his first 3 years as a starter, two trips to the playoffs, I think a better completion percentage than any of the quarterbacks that I had just listed there, it just seems odd that they're kind of diminishing that work, right? And doing that in a very public way.
Yeah. I agree that it was just such a strange approach. You know, if someone said to me, Connor, who, or, you know, Jenny, who, you know, imagine how you'd feel. I mean, actually, Connor, that probably happens a lot to both of us. So
I was just going to say that.
You know, I'm struggling to get seats at preseason games these days. So, you know, Jenny, who seems like something that I may come across, in my daily life. But you're right, everyone takes a turn at the top of the position. You know, I think, you know, they seem to be counting on, you know, Bell's contract kind of bringing the running back contracts down a little bit from Gurley, that Gurley was this outlier, and that they were kind of regressing back to where the running back market had previously sagged to. But if you're Elliott, you're not hearing that.
It's funny to me because it's like, really, in the case of Dak Prescott, it's probably, you know, whatever. You ask for 40, they say 30, and then the quarterback market right now is around 35. And so, you know, you just wait to settle there because, you know, that's what makes sense. Ezekiel Elliott, I'm not sure how much the financial difference is going to end up being, but if you're Jerry Jones, who you've never in the past been seemingly concerned about the salary cap and have dug your team into some pretty awful situations with your mismanagement of it, why do you care? I mean, you know, it seems like it's essentially between these two guys, maybe the matter of difference of $10 or $11 million over the course of a couple years. And wouldn't that be worth it to you to have your best team on the field happy and competitive? And this division's wide open, I think, with a chance to go back to the playoffs.
Yeah, a chance that, you know, you feel like this is a good window to make that push. I agree, Connor.
Connor, I think we're both feeling like the player here. Like you said, you're having a hard time getting seats at preseason games. I'm not even allowed in the concierge lounge anymore. Like we used to, you know, we're getting crushed here. This has been a tough summer.
All right, moving on to other summers that have been, you know, hyped. Spicy comments we're unhyped, just to be clear. Spicy comments out of Cleveland, surprise, surprise. Weeks after Odell Beckham's revelatory GQ interview, Baker Mayfield follows up with one of his own, telling the fashion magazine, that he couldn't believe the Giants drafted Daniel Jones and insinuated that Jones was not a winner. Odell Beckham also told SI that he believed the Giants were sending him to Cleveland to die. What is with all the strange hatred toward a team they don't even play until 2020? The Giants and the Browns don't play till 2020 is what you mean.
They don't.
Okay. Yeah.
But I don't know. I thought it was interesting that Pro Football Talk kind of took up for Baker Mayfield, and they said that this seems to be the MO of GQ, where they get this guy into a dinner setting or to a photo shoot. It's the same reporter that did the Jalen Ramsey interview last year that you'll remember, that he just went through and he trashed all the different quarterbacks. And so that maybe there's this sort of MO that they're able to coax this out of them, and that the players aren't accustomed because it's not a locker room setting, and they're not sure what's on the record or off the record. But I don't know. I mean, I think Baker's a pretty smart guy. I think he probably knew what he was doing, or, you know, I think he's media savvy enough to know that, you know, you don't know this guy, and so you probably need to be careful what you say, if he cared about what he said at all. I mean, maybe it doesn't really matter to him.
Yeah, it's really, the one thing that's odd is that, you know, you keep hearing out of Cleveland, like, you know, don't feed into the hype, and Freddie Kitchens is all about that. But, you know, the players themselves are, placing, amplifying the target that's on their back, you know, with some of the comments that they've said. And I agree with you. I mean, these are all smart players who are used to being out in the media, you know, used to having a lot of coverage on them. So I guess the question behind some of those comments, which your original topic asks, I think, is like, what's the point of saying it, or what's the motivation? Why would Baker Mayfield take a shot at Daniel Jones? It doesn't seem to make a ton of sense. And, you know, Odell saying they sent me to Cleveland to die. I mean, I guess that's a little bit different because he still has some hard feelings about the trade. But there's a lot of noise coming out of Cleveland that is self-generated.
Yeah, I feel like, and maybe they have all recognized that this is that collective personality, like you and I like to say that everything comes back to the 2010 and 2011 Jets. I mean,
yes.
Those were teams that similarly were not afraid to put targets on their back until they were, right? There was a point where it got to be too much, and we remember when Rex Ryan sort of changed his tone and stopped, you know, putting it on the players and started putting it on himself. But this seems very early 2010 Jetsy to me, where everybody is excited about it, they're feeding in to it, and you know, it can propel a team, I think, full of type A personalities, but I think it also makes your job harder than it needs to be.
That was a great analogy, because you're right. Rex did that. He said, I'm going to put it all on me and take it off the players a little bit, and that was his, you know, his approach there. I think the Browns have been trying to rein things in, but I think what happened last year was they had a young core that everyone got excited about. Mayfield had success, you know, early as a rookie, and the hype train left the station. It's sort of different than the current Jets team, right? Because Sam Darnold, you know, he showed promise as a rookie, but it was tough it was a tough season in a lot of ways, and the head coach gets fired and there's a lot of change. So people are excited about Sam Darnold, but it's not the same hype machine that's surrounding the Browns right now.
Jenny, during your career as a competitive youth swimmer and a Science Bowl champion, what did you opt for, the noise strategy, or did you like to sneak up on your opponent?
My life theory is basically, if you ever brag about something, it will come back to bite you, and someone will say my thinking is, if you get overconfident, then you assure that that thing won't happen. So I always am about the under promising but
I am too. I mean, I play in like a rec softball league, like a town softball league. I was not on the team originally this year. They brought me in because a lot of people had scheduled vacations and they needed someone to fill out the roster. And I was very clear from day one that I said, I'm very bad and I don't know why I'm here, but just put me in a place where the ball is not going to be hit to me. And, you know, I think then if you make a catch, that's great. I don't often, but you know, if you don't, then everybody says, well, he came in, you know, he was honest about his limitations coming in. You know, I think there's something to be said for that.
I agree, Connor. You know, maybe we get farther in life if we were operators, but that's just not either of our styles. So we just got to stick with what we know is really what it comes down to.
We can't play for the Browns. We just, we'd fit better somewhere else. Maybe in New England. I don't know. Maybe we'd be good Patriots.
Yeah, maybe. That's a pretty good, big compliment though.
That's right. We'd be champions. All right. So our last item here is something that I've thought a lot about, I think, over the last few days. I think there's been some great writing on. A lot of people, I think, have had some smart things to say about this. Jay-Z and the NFL are teaming up to amplify the league's social justice efforts and take a hold on the fledgling music and entertainment branch in a move that seems maybe a little more corporate than heartfelt. I'm curious, though, Jenny, what do you make of this? I mean, this is a very big move at a strange time for the NFL, but largely it has been viewed as sort of a, you know, I don't know what the right word is here, but maybe, hey, look over here, we're doing this. Don't pay attention to what's really going on.
Right. And absolutely, there's been issues the last couple of years booking halftime acts, and you've had artists, you know, Jay-Z himself has talked about that in his lyrics. And you have other artists saying that they had conversations with Jay-Z about the NFL halftime acts not being involved with them because of the way Kaepernick was treated. So you have, you know, by announcing this partnership, that is clearly one factor. I think we've heard from both sides in response to Jay-Z and some of the comments he made announcing the partnership. Certainly Colin Kaepernick and Eric Reid and Kenny Stills, who have risked a lot by protesting, and some of them who are still in the league continue to protest, felt the choice of words he made about, you know, we've moved past the protests and its usefulness, I think really stuck with them, because they are continuing to protest for reasons that are very important to them. I saw a thread over the weekend that I thought was very thoughtful, and it talked about how both protest and progress, or however you want to put it, they're not mutually exclusive, right? You can continue to protest while also working on tangible steps. And so I don't think the two should be pitted against each other. And I think perhaps that's where Jay-Z's comments went a little bit awry, right? You can work on all of these. If you choose not to protest, that's fine. If you choose to just work on the action, that's fine. One is not superior to the other, right? And so I think Jay-Z has worked on in a lot of areas of social justice in the past, and I think there could be many good things that come out of this partnership. But I also don't think it should be pitted against or made to undermine the choice of those who continue to protest and believe that that is their best way to keep these important issues of equality in our country and, you know, institutionalized racism at the forefront. And so I think, unfortunately, we've seen sort of this division in people who are working toward the same thing, but taking approaches to it, different approaches to it. And I think a lot of the back and forth we've seen is from people that have different views on the best way to move forward.
It's in a way like it feels similar to what ended up becoming the Players Coalition and you know, initially the movement with Colin and Eric, right? Where like one felt that the other was maybe a little bit more of a corporate approach, whereas the other one was that more raw, visceral, like, this is what we actually want to get accomplished approach. You know, and like you said, I mean, what, you know, you wrote that story where what ended up coming out of all this, the social justice efforts from all 32 teams, I mean, there was good that was done, right? I mean, mm-hmm. There was positive things that happened in a lot of communities because of kind of mainstreaming the efforts, I guess, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, so absolutely. That's exactly right, right? You know, Players Coalition working with the NFL, we've seen tangible results coming out of that. At the same time, the players who have knelt and continue to kneel and push for the respect for continuing to kneel, right? They are achieving important steps forward too. And the whole reason we're talking about any of this is because Colin Kaepernick put it, you know, center stage and risked his career to do so. I think that both approaches are valid. And I think what's hard sometimes is when you're working toward raising awareness for an issue, it's so easy to get frustrated at like the lack of progress. And there's not one clear path, right? I mean, and I think the how brave Kaepernick was to put this issue to the forefront. I could understand why any comments that seem to say that we've moved on from that would be, he would be sensitive to those, right? And at the same time, I think the other side feels like we're also working and there will be good things that come out of the actions that we're taking. I just don't think that they should be mutually exclusive. I think we should sort of honor all efforts as moving the ball forward.
I think it's what's kind of amazing to me is how many different times, even over the past year, if you want to take different examples, which are not, similar things, but just in the sort of the gravity of the public, how many of these issues could be cleared up with a better press conference, with better preparation. And that goes with, you know, that goes for general managers speaking out about domestic violence. That goes for coaches addressing, their players' efforts to combat social injustice. What Jay-Z said at this press conference, like the lack of preparation to me just seems stunning. And then that way it's a lack of polish. And then it invites, I think, so much more criticism publicly than if everybody involved took more time to understand the issues and to put together something thoughtful to present to the public instead of, Jay-Z seemed frustrated at that press conference. You know, when you go back and watch it, like, he didn't expect any of these questions. And, you know, if you're there to amplify the league's social justice efforts, how do you not think you're going to be asked about Colin Kaepernick? And how do you not have something thoughtful put together to say about that?
I agree. I do think thoughtfulness and the preparation, then, you know, that makes such a difference. It's all about how it's presented, right? You know, if you yeah. said there, we wouldn't be here without Colin Kaepernick, and we support the right of people who continue to protest or demonstrate during the national anthem. And, I've worked on this partnership because I feel like we can do a lot of good work. I think it's all in how it's presented. And I agree, Connor. I think there could be other steps taken to sort of head off some of those things.
Yeah, no, it's going to be interesting moving forward. And not to make light of the situation, I mean, obviously this is not, the point of this, but he is also taking over the media arm of the NFL in a way. So maybe a better halftime show at some point. Maybe you go to a place like Atlanta and actually have a halftime show that is reflective of the musical history and culture. And, you know, and so maybe, where's the next Super Bowl? Where are we
going? Miami.
Miami? Yeah, so maybe something that is authentically Miami, I think. Maybe that we can hope for something like that. I don't know.
Well, thanks, Connor, for calling in from Buffalo. This is the end of today's MMQB podcast. See you soon.